Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses, and I do it for an audience of real entrepreneurs who are building their businesses often while they're listening to these interviews. And joining me today is a former music industry exec who said, you know what? The world is changing. Actually, people online now are starting out in their bedrooms, in their living rooms, at school, just recording, uploading stuff to the internet, to YouTube, Spotify, to SoundCloud, to all these different services, and some of them are going to be huge, and the music industry has to understand how to work with them. And he thought, and he came up with an idea for how to do it. And that idea became a company called Instrumental. His name is Conrad Withey.
That's right.
By the way, first mistake already. If I ever make any other mistakes in the interview, totally fine to correct me. I hate when I listen to someone else's interview and I realize that the guest is being railroaded by the host and the host is making mistakes and I'm not looking for my ego. Good. Keep correcting me. Instrumental is an online talent discovery specialist focusing on the music industry. They help, at this point, largely the music industry, find these hidden gems of people who are going to be huge in the future. We're going to find out how he built this up into a successful company in a world where, frankly, I feel like there's so many music startups that have failed, that have gotten really badly hurt. How is he doing well? I wanted to find that out. We invited him here to learn about that, and we can do it thanks to two phenomenal companies. The first is a business that he and I have both used. It's called Design Crowd. It'll help you hire phenomenal designers. And the second will help you host your website, right? It's called HostGator. Conrad, good to have you on here.
Thanks, Andrew. Great to be here.
You know what? I was fascinated by your background at Warner Music. And in my head, I had all these different stories that you could tell about rock and roll and how you discovered musicians. And before the interview started, I asked you about one. And can you tell the audience what you told me?
Yeah. Yeah, I think I'm the least rock and roll music industry exec you're going to have on a show, on this podcast. But yeah, I suppose I was probably best known at Warner's anyway for being the kind of counter-programming A&R guy. I was doing the stuff nobody else was interested in, certainly the least cool stuff. And a good example of the kind of projects I did when I was there was, I've always been audience-driven, always been fascinated by people building audiences that you can sell stuff to. And I was watching House, the hit show all over the world. I think it was the biggest show in the world at one time. Hugh Laurie, big British star in that show. My wife and I absolutely adored it. And we were watching that one evening. And Hugh was playing piano in one of the episodes, playing blues piano. And we were both like, my God, he actually looks like he's really playing that. And he's pretty good. And my wife goes, you should email him and see if he'll do a record. You know, that's nuts. The biggest TV show star in the world. I just email him anyway. I email his management. Weirdly, an hour later, I got back a note saying, come in and have a chat. I think this is too easy. Anyway, I went in and we talked, and eventually I met Hugh for a cup of tea and we talked about making an album. And I went back to my boss and I said, look, I'm going to do a record with Hugh Laurie. And he goes, what? Actors singing? That's just the worst idea. This isn't going to work in a million years. Anyway, he let me do it. He did about 1.5 million records around the world. And he turned out to be a genuine star. And I think for me, it was, you know, I just kind of look in places other people aren't looking for opportunities. And that was sort of my approach in the music business anyway.
And what attracted you to him was you liked his music. Did you also say, hey, people are watching House all over the world. Yeah. They're going to want to at least give him a try. And if they do, I know that they're going to like his music because I do.
Yeah, I think it sort of gives you a head start. In the music business, the biggest thing you've got is how do you break an artist or how do you get a project to be successful and deliver a return on investment? And the thing I thought about that was, well, 80 million people or whatever are watching this globally, maybe mm-hmm. even more. He'd become this unlikely sex symbol, which meant that women were watching him particularly and liking him as a personality. They're really good music buyers. And I knew you had a person in Hugh who would get onto big TV shows, would get press coverage. The next thing was just, would he make a decent record? Or otherwise, you're going to be shot down. This is a novelty. He happened to turn out to be an extraordinary blues pianist and guitar player and connoisseur of that music. That bit I didn't know. That was probably where we got lucky. But actually, the initial ideas all sort of stood the test of time. And I think that's probably my success in what I've done, business point of view, has always been around if you can find an engaged audience that really likes something, you can build on that and you can probably sell them something too.
What is it that someone once said about you? You're more Rotary Club than rock and roll.
yeah, that was that was great. We were waiting for this piece. We were in the FT. It was in the magazine. It was like front cover, and I was like, "Oh, this is super exciting!" You know, finally, I've never had consumer press. You know, we were signing in the consumer press for the first time, and I read it. You know, you haven't read the piece before it goes live, and there was this quote. I finally sort of got to sit down with me, and he said, yeah, it turns out to be more Rotary Club than rock and roll. So there you go. I wasn't cool anyway, but now everybody knows.
And what you talked about with Hugh Laurie is finding that person who most people would overlook, but you know is going to be big, or you know has a shot at being big. What Instrumental does that online, scours the internet, the places actually that should be scoured, to find that person who isn't huge yet, but has the potential, and you've got a system for doing it, and that's why the company's done so well. I'm curious about how you do so well, and I wonder how much of it goes back to what you did when you were 18 years old. Can you talk about that job and actually what led you to it also?
Yeah. So I left high school. Sixth form college is in the UK. Took a year out and wanted to travel and wanted to fund that travel. So I did some work at home. Then I got a flight over to Australia. And then I got there and I thought, well, I'd like to stay here a decent amount of time. I'm going to get a job. Scout the paper for a job, you know. And there was this job that says, travel Australia and earn at the same time. I'm like, well, that's the dream job, isn't it? So I contacted them and it turned out to be door-to-door encyclopedia selling. And I thought, well, that sounds terrible, but it sounds like it's going to tick both the boxes I need. So I applied, and obviously, I think most people who apply to be a door-to-door encyclopedia seller get a chance of doing it. It's not a very high bar. But then I got in, and they trained me up. I mean, just selling encyclopedias seems so old school, doesn't it? But that was the opportunity for me to do something that allowed me to just, I suppose, solve that problem of how do you fund a gap year. But actually, it turned out to be the most incredible eye-opener to what sales is like. You know, just they would send you out with this example, one single volume encyclopedia, and you'd literally just go door knocking. And you would be taught the kind of patter that would hopefully get you to set up a meeting for someone to go and sell them a set. But you would be taught all these amazing rebuttals and all these kind of ways to sort of find your way into these people's lives. And I think that there's no sharper learning curve than literally going down 200 or 300 doors a night, and you don't know who's going to open up behind the door. You don't know what kind of personality you're going to face. Is it someone who's going to be aggressive, or is it someone who's going to be lovely? Or
what do they teach you about that? I feel like I wish that schools would force everyone to do some kind of sales, ideally door-to-door sales, if for no other reason than just to make it less threatening to send out an email to a potential employer, or better still, a potential client. There's too much hesitation that we all naturally feel about it, but if we were to do it on a regular basis at school, even if it's just for 6 months, it would feel less threatening. It would... Yeah. You'd understand the rationale behind it. Like you were talking about how they taught you the rebuttals. So you actually had to get a talk about the rebuttals. And
so they were, one of the things is obviously encyclopedias are expensive. And most people are like, well, I'm not in the market for that. I can possibly afford that. And so they teach you a series of reasons why you can afford it. You know, why, how you can prove someone can afford it. You talk about, you know, you're like, well, do you buy any, do you buy newspapers? You know, what's your kind of month daily disposable income? And well, you know, these cost $2 a day. So of course you can afford it. And you sort of work your way through. But I think back to your point, I totally agree. Anybody, I mean, ideally everybody would get a chance to do it, but of course it's not really going to happen. But the ability to not be put off by rejection is the thing that you learn quickly. Is the first 50 doors are probably going to be slammed in your face. The next one is the one that turns into an opportunity. And if you don't get used to that rejection and the fact that doesn't matter, it's like each one of those is its own little learning curve, and you get better and better and better.
Tell me about one of the rejections or one of the knocks that didn't end up in a sale that you remember.
I can remember quite a few time-wasted ones where I remember one guy that I thought this was my dream. I knocked on his door and he was unbelievably friendly. And my pitch was just going down a dream, and I was like, "This is great!" And he invited me in. I thought, "Wow, this is this is fast tracking the process. He sat me down. He said, tell me all about it. And I did. And it's about 15 minutes to pitch. And then at the end of that, and he said, well, listen, that's all very interesting. Thank you very much. Let me tell you about Jesus. It's like, okay. He was a Jehovah's Witness, and he was used to knocking on doors himself.
That's why he was finally friendly.
And then this dude, this dude turned up and knocked on his door. So he welcomed me in. So I sort of, you know, wasted some time there. But most of the time, it was just people annoyed. You know, you're invading their evening, their kind of post-work time. You know, it's a bit annoying. And I get that. And mm-hmm. I think the interesting thing is, related to business now and what we're doing, and what I've done before is you just have to keep chipping away, and you will find the person for whom you're a great fit. And if your solution is clear enough and you can illustrate that quickly, and actually the failing fast is a great learning. You know, it doesn't matter, just fail, you know, just move on quickly. So the slam door actually at least gets you to a close. You know where you're at. It's just the face-to-faceness of it makes it feel a little bit more intense.
You ended up working at Boots, at Kraft as a brand manager, and then you just ended up in the entertainment industry for a big chunk of your life. What does it look like? About a decade or two, almost 20 2 decades.
20 years nearly now, yeah. I always wanted to be in media and entertainment.
So how did you even get into it?
Everyone wants to. I tried sort of writing and letters and applying. I came from the north of England. I didn't know anyone who was in media and entertainment. So it was a difficult way in. And actually, that's why I ended up at Boots, because I was like, all my efforts failed. So I thought, well, I'll go and get marketing training. If I get training in something that could be, you know, used in different industries, then that's a good starting point. And I did that for a couple of years, moved to Kraft because it was in London. There's much more going on in London, as you imagine. And after a year and a half there, I was marketing cheese in the Middle East. You know, that was not my dream job, I can tell you. But they're an American marketing company. They teach you incredible best practice. I enjoyed that from that point of view. But then it was like, oh, I need to try and get in. So I just kept looking for opportunities and jobs.
What's the opportunity that finally got you in?
They were looking for a product manager in a marketing department at PolyGram, which in those days was, it's now Universal, but it was a British led actually, it was a Dutch company, sorry, but it was a European music and media company. And I was moving into the music side, and they looked for a product manager, and I applied, and I was lucky. The girl recruiting had been at Boots as a graduate. She wanted someone who wasn't from the music business. You know, most people in music at that time had been in record shops or been in a band, or, you know, you were in that world. And she was trying to find someone who was not typically from the, you know, that background. So
Boots is a pharmacy chain in the UK, right?
Yeah, it is. It's like Walgreens or something.
So she just said, I need somebody who's outside of this space, who can think a little bit differently. And hey, here comes this guy from Boots, who also was a brand manager at Kraft. So he understands some of the things that we're looking for. I connect with him. Let's give him a shot.
Yeah.
And you were in A&R. Isn't that the person who looks for artists?
Yeah, so I did marketing for about 6 months, and then they offered me a role in A&R, which, yeah, it's basically the person who's looking for new opportunities, new talent to sign up and to forge deals with.
And did you find anyone good?
Yeah, well, I started at that point in the video side. So you remember home video, when that was a thing, VHS. And I was signing deals with personalities to do VHSs. To do home video releases. So it was stand-up comedy, it was fitness, it was kids programming. So I was out there going to comedy clubs or going to see shows and seeing if we could turn them into home video properties.
I understand your methodology today. You're looking online for somebody who's a rising star, and there's some indicators when someone's a rising star. I understand what you were doing at Warner, where you were saying, look, this guy Hugh, he's got a big following. I could see how people would be attracted to him. When you were just looking in the clubs, what were you looking for that would tell you that people would actually buy the VHS tapes? How could you tell when someone's a winner with that little information?
It was a little bit like a manual version of what we do now. So you would be scouring all the media you could to see where people were being talked about and where they might be cropping up. Because discovery in those days was only through traditional media. You didn't word of mouth. So on the comedy circuit, you would obviously be looking for people being talked about, reviewed. But also then just, you know, what kind of size venue are they selling? What kind of reaction are they getting to the crowd? So you literally had to sit there and see see it for yourself, and then watch how that develops. So you would keep an eye on someone, and if they were moving up and maybe getting the odd TV show, you'd be thinking, right, this girl's going in the right direction. So
all right, and then you started. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. You then, in 2003, started the Rights Company, a business that you sold 3 years later to Warner Music Entertainment. What was the Rights Company?
So I then took what I'd been doing within places like PolyGram and a company called Momentum Pictures, doing that, just what I was describing, and set up an independent company to do that. So what we would then do is we'd try and spot the opportunity with talent first. We'd go off and sign an option with them, whether they were a comedian or a sportsman or a musician, whatever it was. We'd try and take those rights, hence the name of the company, and then we would try and license them on to big companies and sort of flip them for more money. So we'd try and sign them quickly and then sell them on when they got a bit more valuable and keep the difference.
So what did Warner buy then? It wasn't the rights that you bought because you already had sold them all. What was it that they were buying when they bought you?
At that point, they were expanding their capabilities within the business. They wanted the music company to evolve from being just a record label to being what they describe as like the 360 solution for artists. And a big part of that was content. And we were good at thinking about content ideas and looking for opportunities to partner talent with visual programming.
So they were looking to hire your talent, your team.
Yeah, they pretty much bought a team is really what we did there. We exited a company that...
What'd you sell it for? How much?
I can't disclose that, I'm afraid. Okay. It wasn't a figure that Warner's were comfortable with announcing at the time, so I don't think it's probably worth doing that.
All right.
But it was a good return on investment for... It was about eight and a half time return for our investors, so we were happy with that.
Still trying to get a sense of the scope. You know what? You're from the music industry. I don't think there can be any weird questions. Did it make you a millionaire?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. It was a good
Not
deal.
A few money, just enough to...
Yeah, it was, what it allowed us to do was pay off a lot of debt. I suppose my wife and I both worked in the business, take a step back and actually it took me into a new world because the deal was... In moving me into music at the heart of it, even though I'd sort of started within PolyGram, I was always on the visual side. I was on the video point of business, and I suddenly was in the heart of music. So it actually gave me this 8-year insight into an industry I didn't know a great deal about. So and a time to sort of rethink. You know, I think we exited the business at exactly the right moment. It was a peak of what we're doing. I don't think that company was going to go on and scale, perhaps in a way I hope Instrumental can. But it was a good, solid, profitable business. You know, we'd made money from day one, and therefore it was, I think, a smart acquisition.
Okay, let me talk about my first sponsor, and then get into the big problem that you saw while you were at Warner, which is what led you to start your business. The first sponsor is a company called HostGator, and I've got to tell you, Conrad, about this lunch that I had with a guy named Saeed Balki. He is a guy, you know how people online will say, look, I bought this car, and they'll put a picture of a car. He put a picture recently and he said, look, I bought this building, and the building was the building that the local bank was in, and then he's got his office space at the top. He's constantly buying real estate, and the reason that he could afford to do it is, back when he was a teenager, I interviewed him about this, he founded a blog called WP Beginner, WordPress Beginner, that teaches people how to set up WordPress sites, how to add plugins, what the latest news is about in the WordPress community. And he set up his blog, and then as he found that there were issues that people had, like how do you collect email addresses, he created tools for them. In that case, he created Opt-in Monster. And he has a bunch of other tools, software that he sells on a SaaS basis, like Easy Forms, Easy WP Forms. Anyway, the reason I bring it up is because I had this interesting experience where we sat down to lunch. I was treating, I think, but the first thing he did when he sat down was said, oh, look, a penny. And the guy picks up a penny from the floor and shows it to me like he just got a prize. And he puts it in his pocket, not just like as a joke. He puts it in his pocket and he keeps it. And the thing that drove home to me was he is a guy who's really big on growing his business, really big on revenue opportunities, and still watches the pennies. Where can I save a penny? Where can I make an extra penny to keep this thing growing? And that's what's allowed him to build up his empire, which frankly is beyond software, is also in real estate. And I love talking to him about the real estate that he's bought. So what does he have to do with HostGator? Well, I went on his website to see who's hosting his website, a huge, huge blog in the WordPress community. And the company that hosts him is HostGator. Now, why would HostGator be the company they pick? For a couple of reasons. Number one, they've been around for a long time. They've been dependable since 2002. And number two, the second reason is they're not expensive. We're always looking for the next most expensive solution. You don't need it. HostGator is a solved, I mean, hosting of your website is a solved issue. If you're looking to be like Saeed, build up your business right, you don't need to spend a bunch of money on web hosting, whether it's a blog or an e-commerce site, a SaaS landing page, whatever it is that you need, HostGator's got you covered. Their costs, their price is as low as $3. And you know what? Actually, it's lower. It's $2.64, but I don't recommend you start with that. I recommend you start with the baby plan, which is a $3.95 a month plan, because that comes with unlimited domain. Any idea that you have, you can throw it up on a website. If there's someone you're trying to court as a client, build a website for them. You got unlimited domain hosting with them. Want to court your wife? Want to have a landing page for a party that you're throwing? It's all included. Unlimited domains. Here it is, a special URL where you're going to get up to 62% off their already low prices. Really, be the type of person who cares about the pennies and wants to grow the dollars. Here it is, hostgator.com/mixergy. You'll get a super low price and you'll get tagged as coming from me, which will help me, frankly, guys. They'll know that my ads work, and it'll help you because we protect all of our listeners. If you ever have an issue, we will stand behind you with any one of our sponsors. hostgator.com/mixergy.
Andrew, I've got to show you something. I love that story. Can I stay there?
Yeah, I'd love it. I'm not going to go anywhere. Let's see what you got. What is this? I'm looking over your shoulder.
That story is so funny. Can you see in this little jar? Oh, where is it?
Let me see. I'll hold it up a little higher. Oh,
that's the pennies. So we have this thing in our company. If anyone sees a penny on the road, they have to pick it up and go and put it in this little jar.
Because
I think it's good luck. I think it's also take care of the pennies.
Frame of mind. What was the name of it? I can't remember the name of the company, but boy, I saw them just thrive. And I remember asking somebody who came into my office here for Scotch Night who worked for them. I said, so they must just like have money to spend. He goes, no way. I said, what do you mean? He goes, the founder saw that I once bought a pair of scissors to cut. And I said, okay. He said, no, don't buy a pair of scissors. Go return that. And then he comes in with these rusty scissors from his house to cut. And I thought about it. The scissors is not the point. The point is send a message to the whole team. We're making money, but we're not going to be spendthrifts. We're making money, but we care about the cost of scissors. We care about the pennies. And really, as you're growing, it's really easy for people to get disconnected and say, ah, this guy's rich. Ah, this business is going well. We shouldn't care about the money. Let's go for the faster decision to spend. And these little points, like pick up pennies, put it in the jar, send a message.
I have a theory that when that jar's full, just about there, that's going to be when we really hit it.
That's actually a really good theory. I think there's a correlation there.
About a third of the way up.
When you were in the music industry, you started to see Spotify. What else did you see go on?
Yeah, we saw, I remember being at Warner's and seeing YouTube emerge. About the time I went into Warner's, YouTube just got started. And YouTube gave this environment to any kid to start distributing music, basically. Record it on the iPhone or a little video camera, upload it to YouTube, you could reach a global audience. And these bedroom stars started emerging, which had never happened before. And there was this phenomenon, really, around the fact that you had a kid who could have accumulated a fan base in the hundreds of thousands, even millions, completely on their own, had what we talked about earlier, but had this engaged audience with whom they could do all sorts of things. You know, they could get to go to shows, they could sell them products, they could, you know, they could get them to buy stuff. But they were musicians, but they had not gone through the major label system. And it was this realization that everything was changing in front of our eyes. And then I would look inside the business at the processes and the meetings we would have and the discussions that would go on. And they were exactly the same as they'd ever been. They were like, you know, 20 years ago, it would look just the same as it did at that point. And I just found it odd. I thought this was a strange disconnect between perhaps where we're going and it's the same. You know, big old companies, they take a long time to adapt. So I became fascinated with that. And I remember when I was there trying to sign a kid to a T-shirt deal rather than a record deal, because I had the view, well, we basically give the music away for free on YouTube. He's using that to build an audience and a fan base, but he can sell tons of T-shirts. So why don't we not worry about the music in a way and do the T-shirt deal? And I remember going to finance and saying, can you help me work this deal through. And no one understood how they could do it. And actually,
they didn't understand how to make a deal with this kid who was on YouTube.
No, they didn't understand it. There was no way to structure a deal internally based around selling t-shirts as opposed to selling albums. So that deal wasn't going to happen. And also it was just counter to the culture of the business. So you're like, well, I just thought that was fascinating. There's ways to make money there. And so the inner entrepreneur is like, you know, you should get out and try and figure out what that business is.
All right. And so you said, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to do this. Your first version, the company was called Pop Shack.
That's right. Yeah, that's exactly it. So Pop these Shack. Teen kids, yeah, we were like, we're going to create an environment called Pop Shack. It's going to be all about the younger musicians. So we wanted it to be, you know, fun and unthreatening and a sort of welcome and collaborative community. We wanted to build it on YouTube because that's where I was seeing this talent emerge. So we sort of created a multi-channel network, which is a structure of a business you can build on the YouTube platform. And it's, you know, supported by YouTube themselves. And we were sort of the first music-focused MCN, at least coming out of the UK. And I was then sort of figuring out, well, how do we find this talent first? How do we see them before anyone else? And how do we get in touch with them so that they'll join the Pop Shack network and we can monetize them through these ways, you know, selling t-shirts or brand deals or whatever. So we did that manually. I didn't at that point. I'm not a tech guy, so I hadn't figured there's probably...
You were sitting on YouTube going through the...
Yeah.
Going through what?
Manually searching, probably like you would, for any video. And we had a team of people in London, and then we even built a team in India doing this. We had about 12 people in India searching for us. And we realized a couple of key things. One, YouTube is really good at showing you content that it thinks you might want to watch based on what you've watched before, but it's not brilliant at showing you anything you don't know about or is unconnected to what you've watched. And it doesn't show you everything. You know, it's using an algorithm to try and get you to watch more. So therefore, it's not actually diving down really deep into the depths of the content ocean that is YouTube to find the things that are starting to move that are not there yet. So we weren't finding enough talent. We were like, we know there's more out there, but we just can't find them. I think we got to about 3,000 artists through manual search. We just like, there's more than this.
Well, let me pause it for a second.
Yeah.
Pop Shack was founded by your wife, right?
Yeah. Well, her and I, yeah.
I see. Okay. And initially, from what I saw on Click Z a while back, she was doing this as a way of doing what? Well, I thought that I understood it, but I'm not sure that I'm following. Because when I look at this, a Click Z says, the day that you became CEO of the company, it says, Pop Shack reaches over 2.2 million subscribers and drives 8 million video views per month.
That's right. Yeah.
How did that work then?
So she kicked off the Pop Shack project. I joined from Warner's about a year and a half later, full time. And then at that point, so the network had by then, I think we had it. Probably about 150 artists. I can't exactly remember. When you accumulate the video views of the artists on the network, you get to that big number. So what you're doing is, as a collection of talent posting videos on their own individual channels, as a network, you can represent that whole group.
And represent them to who?
So what I mean is you are managing the content that they're putting out on their channels, and you can represent them to brands, say. So for example, you could go and talk to a brand who wants to reach a teenage audience and say, look, we can reach this demographic through this network. Why don't you sponsor the content, or why don't you get involved with some of the talent that we're working with? Because if you think about the challenge brands have got reaching a young audience now, is that there aren't many places to go beyond online. And YouTube's obviously a rich environment for that. So we were trying to build a kind of kids network based around music that would be exciting for brands to partner with. Make sense?
Yeah. And your idea was, you know what? We can actually discover some of them and make them into record, into music stars with record deals and so on. And what I wrote as a note to myself is, why would they even want to be discovered today? I see some of these people on YouTube. Why would they even need a record deal? That I'm trying to think of who it was. It was one of the Paul brothers, Jake Paul or his brother, who just put this goofy song on Spotify, and I found myself listening to it a bunch of times, and I realized he doesn't need a record company to get him on there. He could just go put it on Spotify at the end of one of his videos, say, and you know what, this is actually the song that I put on Spotify, go listen, and I'll go listen.
Yeah, he definitely doesn't need a record deal. You're absolutely right.
And so why would anyone at that point need a record deal if they're big on YouTube?
Yeah, it depends. You've got to remember that not everyone is that level, that big. And it's interesting because some of the big, like Shawn Mendes was big on YouTube, was big on Vine. He did a record deal. Virgin EMI, you were like, well, he doesn't need to. But actually, Virgin EMI were able to take him from what he was doing and turning him into a global. Global pop star. They were able to galvanize a level of support from traditional media that he wasn't getting in the YouTube environment alone.
But that's such a small group of people. It's like 20, let's say 20, let's say even 100. 100 people are going to be that. You're not trying to find the 100 people who are going to do
that. Wasn't our strategy. So for us, 1 in 100 might go on and do a record deal. We were much more interested in the group, the community, and what we could do with them. So for us, the interesting model we thought was going to be selling merchandise and selling live shows, tickets to shows, to introducing brands into that environment. It was the rest of the mix that we thought was going to be.
Okay, and you thought if we could find them, that it doesn't have to be the top 100. If it's the top 1,000 or so,
we can
help them monetize their passion and their art, and we'll collect a little bit of money for doing that. All right. And you went on YouTube. I interrupted you as you were saying, we started looking on YouTube. We found a bunch of artists, but that's slow. And obviously YouTube also will start to customize it to your interests. So where you're trying to figure out what the top top musicians are in general, what they're trying to do is give you the top for you and repeat the ones that you like. And so you decided we have to adjust this. What was the adjustment?
So we just were obsessed with the idea there was a lot of talent we were missing. So we started to talk to data science people and explore what you could do beneath the surface, beneath the algorithm. And this is where I started to learn about the power of data science, because, you know, very quickly people were saying, well, you know, you can take the YouTube API and you can you know, interrogate it and find out what's going on behind the algorithm. I was like, really? So we built some basic tech, and the first version was quite cool. It was looking at every new music video uploaded in the last 24 hours. And it was then saying, I'm not interested in anything that's on Warner's or Vivo or the major platforms. I just want to look at the other stuff. And then it was saying, right, out of all of those videos, I just want to rank them by the ones that have got the most views in the last 24 hours. And then I'll prepare a chart. So each morning it would give us this chart. I remember the first time we sort of turned it on properly, we went in the next day and we looked at what was in there, and there were about 120,000 artists. We got to 3,000 in probably a year. So it's like, oh my God, you know, this is a much bigger sense of what's going on. And, you know, those 120,000, they had to have released something pretty recently. I think they have to put something up in the last 7 days or something. 30 days, I can't remember, but it was just an idea of a sense of scale that you've got that you couldn't see through a manual route.
And then you went to potential customers and you said, here's some data.
Yeah.
Right. And what were you trying to sell to them or learn from them in those early conversations when you had all that data?
So there were the two things sort of happened at the same time. One was that model that I described to you for Pop Shack of finding brands and selling merch. We were finding that wasn't scalable. We sort of hung at a brick wall, and you know, revenues were not predictable, and the investors were scratching their heads. And we were sort of regrouped and we're like, well, what have we got here that's actually cool and actually solving a problem? And we thought this tech could be that thing. So what I was going out was sort of saying, well, we've solved this problem for ourselves. We were trying to do something and we found it difficult, and we've now found a way of doing it better through tech. Does it solve a problem for you? Could it be something that we could sell to you or that you could benefit from? So I just, again, I door-knocked in a way. I went to see people I knew, obviously use your network. But we also just started sending out emails to people. And because it was YouTube, we thought, well, let's send emails to all sorts of different sectors. Let's send it to fitness, to, you know, to motor manufacturers, to the food industry, and just see who sort of bites and who's interested.
And who did bite? What were the results?
We did get a really eclectic set of positive responses, you know, from magazine editors to to brands. And I went and see, you know, sat down with lots of them, showed them what we're doing and sort of grilled them on what their challenges were. And the two that became most interesting, well, music was always one because we'd been started there. But then a lot of people were getting excited about influencer marketing. And YouTube being a ripe breeding ground for influencers, there was a lot of interest from brands initially saying, we're looking for the next big thing in the influencer world. Can you help us with that? And we became quite interested in that. I thought, well, God, the marketing budgets out there are huge. Can we tap into that? Could that be our way into a big business? So actually for 12 months, we were doing both. On the music side, they'd asked us to explore Spotify as well. So we started looking at data science solutions around Spotify and went that way. And then on the influencer piece, we just kept going out and seeing if we could get money out of brands. And we did. We did get cash out of brands. We got campaigns and we ran them successfully. But the biggest pain we found on that side was campaigns last 3 weeks, you know, a month, maybe 2 months, and then they're over. And then you're kind of back to scratch. So you're constantly having to try and win new business. You sort of turn into an agency that's seeking out brand campaign money that's not very reliable and not very predictable.
And you've raised money at this point, right?
Yeah, so we'd raised funding. You know, there was a round based on the tech and based on the opportunity we thought.
How
we
much
had
did you raise?
It was seed money at that stage. It was a few $100,000. Okay. I can't remember exactly.
I'm going to pause for a second because I see that you're starting to make some sales. You know what? Actually, let me ask about the first or one of the first sales. What was one that stood out from the early days to give me a sense of where you were?
We did a deal which I was super excited about with Pepsi. So we worked with Pepsi on Naked Juice, which is one of their smoothie brands, on a really, you know, sizable influencer marketing campaign. And what we were really trying to sell to them was, you know, you shouldn't just be doing campaigns. You should be constantly looking for influencers. You should be like a record label. You should be trying to find talent that's going to help grow your businesses and partner with them for the long term. And, you know, you should be always on in this search for influencers. But we couldn't change that. You know, we couldn't change the mindset away from campaigns. So we did the campaign. I would say it was a success. They were very happy with how it turned out, but then they went away and that was the end of that. So I was desperately trying to turn them into some sort of subscriber to what we were doing. And they were just sort of stuck in their model, which was campaign.
All right, I'm going to take a moment to talk about my sponsor, and then we're going to come back and talk about the big problem that you had and how that changed the company. My second sponsor is a company called Design Crowd. And before we started, you said that you had an interesting use for Design Crowd. I'll ask you about it in a sec, but just to tell people what it is, Design Crowd is a site where you go in and fill out, I think it's a form with just two questions on it. And then they get a team of designers from all over the world. Actually, they're not even a team. They don't work together. They work against each other. They all send in design ideas based on what you requested. And you only pick and pay for the one that you like. And I've talked about how I used it, but Conrad, you use it too. How did you use Design Crowd? What's the one that you do for clients, I think, is an interesting idea.
Yeah, we never had an in-house designer. So we wanted to improve our sales decks. And it was particularly when we were doing that, trying to pitch to brands, and we wanted each deck to look as impressive as possible. And I went on Design Crowd and found some guys who, you know, would create PowerPoint decks for you from you know, simple slides that we would create and we'd send them over. So we did that thing of, we got three or four of them pitching, and one guy absolutely nailed it. We then paid him for that design, and then actually kept him on. So every time one of the team had a new pitch deck we needed, we would go back to him and give him the brief. And we probably did six or seven different decks with him, maybe more. Yeah, and he was based in the Middle East. It was brilliant.
I never thought to go to them for pitch decks or, frankly, even for keynote. I use keynote presentations all the time. I paid this one company $15,000 to create my presentation once. I thought they were great, super professional. They took my ideas through interviews and they turned them into slides, which I loved. But the part that really stuck with me was how beautiful the slides looked. It made my ideas so much better.
That's it.
And I never thought to go back to Design Crowd and ask them to do that. But now you put a thought in my head. Next time I need, and I always need presentations, I should take the slides that this company created for me and say, here are the ones that I love and why. Yeah. Now, Design Crowd, you create a template for me based on this so that I can reuse that template.
That's it.
All right. I love that. if you're out there, even if you do have a designer in-house, it's so helpful to go to Design Crowd, say what you're looking for, and then get what I, in my case, I had dozens of designers from all over the world, each one with their own perspective on design, on presentation, create something based on your needs. And then you pick the one that you like, only pay for that one. And as Conrad has pointed out, if you pay for someone or if you start to like someone, you don't even have to keep working with them through Design Crowd. They make a match and you're welcome to continue the relationship with that person.
I've got a
URL that Mixergy listeners can use to get up to $100 off and use them the way that I have for, we needed a logo for, are certified professionals at one of the businesses that I run, and they created it. We needed them for cover art. If you need them for slides, if you need them for a web design, for anything that you need designed, go and check them out. And if you just want some inspiration, again, this URL, designcrowd.com/Mixergy, is fantastic for that. You'll get $100 off. You'll see the design that I got, and you'll get some ideas for yourself for how you can get your business to look better, to close more sales because of great design created by a crowd of professional designers. designcrowd.com/Mixergy. The big thing that I was going to bring up was you had to go back to your investors at one point and tell them that your revenue was so low that it hit what number? Do you remember what I'm talking about?
Zero.
Zero. What was that like?
We had a quarter of zero revenue. Yeah. January, February, March that year. And it was hard because we'd actually had a pretty buoyant end the year before, and then just everything stopped. And this was at this time when we were trying to unlock brand money, and it was painful because you set your targets in board meetings, and you then go back a quarter later and tell you how you've done. So going back with a graph that just was flat at zero wasn't working. But
you're a guy who left a job at a major record label, good paying job. Yeah. You had a family. How many kids did you have?
We've got four kids.
Four kids.
Yeah.
And now 2 years into this business, you've got zero revenue. Were you freaking out at night?
Oh yeah.
I freak out sometimes. What were you worried about when you were waking up in the middle of the night with worries?
I had that, you just sort of relayed the story, and that's what I would be going around. You left. Why did you leave? You would have been fine there. No one was telling you your time was up. Why wouldn't you just take the easy option? And I suppose you end up getting through those nights and wake up in the morning and thinking hard again and realizing that the reason you're doing it is because you're partly because you're made that way and you can't really resist the challenge, and partly because not every day is like that. And those moments are quite sobering what it did was it just forced us to step back and look at it and think, right, this isn't working quite clearly. What could work? What thing are we doing if we strip away everything that really does add value and solve the problem? And I think that was such a massive lesson for me because my first business had gone well from the beginning. We've been profitable every year, 3 years. It had grown nicely. The graph did that, and we sold it. It's like, well, that's what it's like. It's quite easy, this running a business thing. And the second one was the opposite. The first business model didn't work. We had a quarter with no revenue. We had a team. It's like, that's painful. So it forced us to think hard and about simplification. And that was the lesson to me, was go away and figure out the one tiny thing you do better than anybody else in the world, or could do better than anyone else in the world.
But, and that was a subscription and a simple product. What was the one thing that you could do better than anyone else?
So we settled on scouting. And scouting is the music and entertainment industry's version of prospecting. So if you look at B2B businesses, there's tons of cool prospecting tools out there that you can use to help try and drive new prospects for your business. And we just felt that was an area that media, particularly music, had not invested in. It's core. If you don't have a good prospecting process, your business will do what ours did and run out of money. You won't have revenue. How you find prospects is how you find talent. So we're like, well, if that has been neglected, is that an opportunity to do something better than anyone else? And we could see this changing world where, we talked about the scale of all this opportunity, the scale of talent out there. We knew that the old ways weren't going to last, and we're going to need to be complemented by some sort of tech. So could we build that tech? We went out. We didn't find a lot of competition. There are companies looking at it. We're not the only ones, but we felt that by just going right into that small thing of how do you keep discovering new talent that's worth a look, and do that better than anyone else. Sort of
like lead gen for the music industry.
It's lead gen. That's exactly it. And the music companies don't think about it as lead gen, obviously, but it is that. It's like it's filling a pipe. They don't think about it like that as well. But I do. You know, I look at our business. And we're constantly trying to fill the pipe with with new deal prospects. And actually, that's what talent is to these businesses. They are new potential partnerships that could be highly valuable from a commercial point of view.
Okay. And so you went back to your clients and you started charging how much at that point for this type of business?
So we pretty much charge the same now as we did then. We guessed at what we thought it was worth. And we sort of looked at, it's interesting, we broke it down as a daily task. And we're like, what we give you is a set of daily prospects, like we were just saying, leads for you to explore. And I thought, well, what value might that be to me on a daily basis? And I thought, well, actually, if someone just came in with this sheet and it was all like hyper-qualified leads, I'd definitely pay them $20 or $25. I think that was money well spent. So we then say, right, I'll do that every day, 30 days a month. It's about $1,000 of value to you. Interestingly, that was also what record labels pay for a scout. So their solution was a young, you know, straight out of uni kid, out there pounding the streets, going to gigs, they pay them about £1,000 a month. And we thought, well, okay, well, if we represent the sort of digital version of that, but actually we might be much more efficient and much more productive, that seemed like a price point to start at. So we tried that.
And that's where you are right now?
Yeah, we haven't actually shifted far from it because people started paying it and we were like, well, that's a good validation. Other people were like, this is too much, come back cheaper. And we said, well, if it gets cheaper, we will. And we were bold enough. And we hired a guy to lead sales who was really helpful for me because he was just saying, no, this is worth more money. This is worth more money. We stay high. And I'm like, okay, it means fewer clients, but it actually means the ones that you've got are very engaged. And I think that was the right call. My instinct was a little bit like, let's get loads of people on and then, you know, we'll grow that way. And I think that was probably a good call.
I have your revenue here on my screen, but I told you I wouldn't reveal it without your okay. So can you say what your revenue was last year?
Yeah, I think last year we topped, in dollars, we were about $1.3 million.
Okay.
So we're just running at a nice, comfortable $120,000 MRR. And our goal at the moment is we want to double that in the next 6 months. That's our kind of company-wide target. So, you know, that's my passion at the moment is we've gone from this lumpy brand world where, you know, we had a quarter with no money to, even though it started smaller, gradually increasing MRR. And it's just a different conversation when you go see the board. You might miss your number a bit, but you're not gonna show a zero. And now it's all about how do we grow that?
Eliminate surprises. Before we started, you told me about a success story. Callum Scott.
Yeah.
I know that he was one of the early success stories before you were charging subscription fees, but I think it gives people a sense of what Instrumental can do. Can you tell us a little bit about who he is and what happened?
Sure. So I mentioned that we started with these YouTube charts when we were looking for talent on YouTube. And we would look at them every day and we're doing, you know, looking for our own reasons and rather than for other people. And we saw this video at the top of the chart, which was Callum's home sort of bedroom recording of this song called Dancing on My Own. Now, the context for him is he had been on Britain's Got Talent, which is a big, you know the show, it's all over the world. He'd done well on the show. I think he got to the final. He had not won it and he had not been signed by Syco, which is the label, you know, Simon Cowell's label. He wasn't picked up by them. His management had then taken him all over the UK industry. No one had signed him. And he'd sort of been left to his own devices and he'd gone home and he'd recorded the song he sang on the show, made this little video, homemade video and put it up. And we were like, we didn't know anything about that, by the way. I knew nothing of that at this point. I hadn't seen the show. We just saw this stat and we're like, bloody hell, this thing is engaging an audience. So we checked it out a bit more and it kept growing and we got in touch with him and said, what are you going to do? This song's unbelievably popular. I went to see Warner's. They weren't interested in it. He was the kid from the TV show who everyone had passed on. And it was a cover. You know, music industry doesn't really like original material. But this cover was working. So we eventually said, well, why don't we put it out? We did a little partnership with him. we helped him sort of move from YouTube to Spotify and iTunes and all of that, and put a campaign around social media together. We didn't spend any money, and this song was released, and it did well at first, and we thought that's quite cool. We did about 3,000 copies or something, downloads, and then it kind of slowed down, and then for some reason the socials just started connecting and it kicked off, and all this data stuff that we'd seen just started to, I guess, truly go viral, because this was not money pushing it, it was just people loved it and they kept sharing it and they showed it to someone else, and this sort of growth came along. Anyway, cut a long story short, that song's done 300 million streams on Spotify now. He sold 1.6 million copies in the UK alone of that exact version that we saw on YouTube. And he got signed to Capitol Records, and he's doing incredibly well, and we're super proud. But I suppose for us, the lesson, what we could have done then is think, we're going to be a label like everyone else. This is it. We've got the formula. But actually what we took from it was we had seen something in data that everything else was, everyone else's prejudice was obscured to see. Their view was this wouldn't work for all the reasons that traditionally it wouldn't have done. He was, come off this TV show and it was a cover and radio doesn't play covers and whatever. And we were just like, an audience is absolutely adoring this song and is viewing it and sharing it and subscribing to him. Let's see if they'll buy it. And we didn't really think a lot more beyond it. We certainly didn't expect it to do what it did. And a lot of credit goes to Capitol, because they took it on and took it to the next levels. We didn't do the whole thing, but that nugget of an opportunity was all in the data and nothing else.
You don't need hundreds of customers in your business to do well. You're where you are now with dozens of customers. We talked about where the first customers came from. Where did the next batch of customers come from?
A mixture, really. It came, we invested in an inside sales team. So we started, pounding the streets in the old door-to-door way. So we would be sending emails, we would be phoning people, and that's worked pretty well. And then we went quite heavy in on PR and content marketing, because part of the challenge we have is we have to sort of get people to rethink the way they do what they've always done, and to embrace technology, to embrace data, and not think it's all about gut instinct. And we felt the best way of doing that was sort of talking about it and sharing new ways, new thoughts. So we've done that through content. We built a blog called 45, where we showcase the talent that we can see in the data. And we talk about...
That's not the one that's on your site?
So we have a blog on the Instrumental website, but we have a separate site, FRTYFVE.com, 45. And that is our kind of, it's a content marketing platform we use. So we write about the artists we're discovering, and what happens is labels will discover that site through these emerging talent, and then they'll find that Instrumental's the sort of power behind that content. So we're sort of throwing out these little baits, and hopefully trying to hook a potential customer. And it's actually been incredibly successful. It gives us a sort of a credibility in the music space, because we're writing about music. We show we're passionate about the subject. We're not pure tech heads trying to, coming out of Stanford or something and think we can solve all the problems. We recognize that the journey this talent needs to go on after we've, thrown up a prospect is a long and detailed and does need lots of expertise and support. But we think we're really good at that discovery bit, and we want to share it through content.
And Conrad, you're reaching out beyond music too, right? To where?
Yeah. So that was another eye-opener, because we sort of began to finesse this process, and then we realized that actually other media companies need to try and find talent and have the same problem. So we work with book publishers, looking for all sorts of different creators, whether they're food bloggers or fitness. We work with a company called Nitro Circus, who we love, who are based out in San Diego, Extreme Sports, and we help them find emerging, kids doing scooter tricks and stuff. So we're leveraging the data for different...
Who's looking for that? Who's trying to figure out who the next extreme sports YouTuber is?
Well, in their case, they put on, I don't know if you know the company, but they put on quite extravagant shows and they tour those shows around the world.
Oh, so you might have one customer who says, we need to find the next big hits for our event. Yeah. And you'll say, okay, we didn't have an extreme sports division before. We'll go into extreme sports to help you find it. So more and more,
you're looking at that sort of thing.
And more and more, it looks like what you're seeing is your talent, your specialty is not just the music industry. It's uncovering future talent that's growing online.
Yeah,
You might need to change your name again.
Well, from instrumental, being instrumental is hopefully what we are. We, you know, that's the useful thing about. Okay. Yeah, it's got two meanings, and yeah, so hopefully we won't change it again. But yeah, I think the process is the same. You're looking for commercially interesting creative talent, and actually we just point the machine at a different set of data and apply some different filters, and up come extreme sports.
Yeah, you know what? When I was searching, when I was trying to figure out what keywords were sending traffic to you, artificial intelligence or AI was one of the things that people were searching for. I saw your eyes light up as I said it. Do you have AI capabilities, or are people just looking for artificial intelligence and landing on your site?
No, we do. So we have some, I would call low-level machine learning in the system at the moment. So that might be looking at tags and trying to interpret what a piece of content is better, because often people don't classify their music or their video correctly, or are thinking about, you know, what we're trying to do. So we use machine learning to better cluster content and help make sense of it. We're also investing in prediction AI. So what that is about saying if various different things are happening at the same time, and we know from looking back over 12 months of data that that combination of events is more likely to lead to some future success, then we want to rank you more highly than something else. And that's just a continuous process. The more data we collect, the cleverer we can be about knowing what's going to happen next. But I don't think we're ever looking to say what you did at the beginning, this is going to be Ed Sheeran in 10 years. I think that's completely impossible. But what I think you can say is right now, these are really encouraging signs. So you should definitely check this out first, you know, in the morning when you're having your coffee. This is the one to look at first.
Let me close this out by pulling the curtain a little bit so that people can see behind the scenes. You and I were scheduled to do this interview on Tuesday at 6 p.m. my time, which was got to be what, your time?
It was about 11 or midnight, yeah.
Which is madness for you to have done an interview at that time. I understand why you'd want to reschedule it. And then we had to find a way to make it work for us. The time difference between San Francisco or California, where I am, and London, where you are, is really difficult. What's it like running a business when you are time-wise so out of sync with much of the U.S.?
Yeah, it's a challenge. I have to say, I was very pleased that we brought U.S. customers on quite early and have kept them, because I did think that was going to be a big problem. The great thing is the data. The data is the data, and it's global, and it's real-time.
They're not looking to have conversations with you and consulting services.
That's
with
it, you. Yeah. They're able to get on with a lot of it themselves. But that said, we have just opened up an office in New York, which will help us bridge that gap. We're sending people out to the West Coast so we can, you know, get better at it. But
potential clients do still want to have a conversation.
Yeah, there totally needs to be the relationship there. And often, we were saying, the relationship starts with our sort of standard product, but quite quickly it sparks ideas that these guys will have. So, you know, we've got clients like Disney over on the West Coast, and the guys there are full of ideas about how they can improve what they do and how we might be able to help them. And absolutely, we need to go over there and sit and spend time with them. And
yeah, I'll give you an example. So your website, weareinstrumental.com, for anyone who wants to check out the business, has got a chat box on it, which is really helpful when someone's making a decision this big. I went into chat right now and it says, we'll return tomorrow at 1 a.m.
Yeah, which, there you go. There's our issue.
it's a challenge. And you're saying it hasn't crippled you. It has been enough of an issue that you're now starting to think about how we have more.
We're absolutely trying to address it. And I think, you know, it's not just the West Coast. We have clients the other way. In the East, we're working a lot with companies across Asia. So actually, the good thing about London is if you think about Asia...
You are in the middle of Asia and the US.
You are in the middle, yeah. But for sure, our biggest opportunity is the US. And so New York's our first move to try and help.
Yeah, I've been wanting to live in Spain for a year. And my wife and I have been talking about it for a long time. I love Spain. The time difference would drive me crazy, which is why we ended up in Argentina when we did instead of Spain, because the time was a little easier.
Yeah, Spain's great though. You should. Have you been?
Yeah, I love it. I love it. I love the little cities in Spain. That I don't love Barcelona that much. I get why I'd want to be there, but the smaller cities are the ones that really excite me. What do you love about Spain?
Oh, food is incredible.
Oh yeah,
and I agree. Places like San Sebastian, if you haven't been there and had that. the Pinchos bars in San Sebastian are insane. They're like their version of tapas. It's Basque. So it's a different, but oh God, I just love it.
See, for me, that would be the ideal place to live again for 1 year and eat the food and live the life. And as long as you have high speed internet, who cares?
Yeah, I totally agree. Let's do it.
I'm a little committed now. My wife just got another job at another tech startup here in San Francisco. We can't even move across the bridge because it's too convenient for her to live and be.
Right, you're stuffed. You see, I made the right move. My wife works with me here, so wherever we go.
I saw you two have been working together for over a decade, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, on and off. We took a break. When we sold the business to Warner's, I made her redundant. She went off and had three kids.
I saw. She took some time off.
Yeah.
You were in it. I don't know what it's like to work with your wife. I couldn't do it. I love Olivia. I'd love to spend time with her. I don't think I could enjoy working with her. That would drive me crazy.
Yeah, a lot of people say that. Yeah, and actually, it isn't easy, but it's also there's huge upsides. It's like, you know, who do you trust more to be in your business?
Yes.
You both got your best interests at heart, and she's great at kind of. I think with the team, she has a different role to me in that the relationship with the team is a useful, you know, foil to have for discussions. And actually what we do is because, as you say, if you've got great internet, you can work anywhere. So we try and work separately as much as possible. So she'll probably work out of the office more than I will. It seems to work. And so far, so good.
All right. The website is weareinstrumental.com if you want to go check them out. And I want to thank my two sponsors who helped make this interview happen. The first is a company that we have both used. Conrad and I have gone for great design from a company called Design Crowd. If you want to check them out, go to designcrowd.com/Mixergy. And if you want your website hosted right by the guy who finds pennies on the floor and gets excited about it and who then ends up building these tremendously successful multi-million dollar companies, and he's done this over and over, Saeed uses HostGator. I highly recommend them. Go check them out at hostgator.com/Mixergy. Conrad, thanks for doing this.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye, everyone.
It's been fun.